begin. We are still in Perek Yudchet, still in chapter 18. And I wanted to cover a couple of things from last time, because we had that break last week because of Purim when we didn't have a session. And there were actually some questions raised that I thought would be good to begin with to help us get back into the mindset. In general, this chapter 18 has been an introduction to a whole bunch of relationships for David, and how everybody loves David, and how difficult this is for Shaul HaMelech, for King Saul. And the last bit of it, sentences 20 to 24, we had talked about Shaul's attempt to marry David to his daughter Michal. First he tried Merav, David refused, Merav married Adriel, and then news gets to Shaul that Michal loves David, and we talked about how it was that Shaul knew that, whether it was that she sent a request to her father or something else. But we said that Shaul pitched the idea to David. We do not have a reaction on the part of David recorded. The text does not say what David said in response, so that some view it as David declining and it just didn't bother to say so. Others view it as David not responding, thinking he's being mocked, as we talked about. And then instead, Shaul had his servants pitch the idea to David, sort of on the side, that David should marry Michal. Whether they're speaking officially for the king, as Radak argued, or they're speaking on their own, as Ralbag seems to say, was unclear. But what we're going to find out today is that David accepts. David indeed wants to marry Michal suddenly. So two notes from last time. Number one, someone had asked the question about the etymology of the name Merav. So it seems to me that Merav means plenty, right? Like from the word harbe. I can't think of another reasonable etymology for the word. There are words that are close, but don't seem to make a whole lot of sense. Michal, on the other hand, I think is a stream, like a stream of water. And my basis for that, for those who either have a full Tanakh or whose Shmuel includes Shmuel Bet, if you take a look at Shmuel Bet, chapter 17, sentence 20, you find a stream of water, and it's called a Michal. So that's where I get it from. There is also a word later, not in Tanakh, a Michal as a volume measure. But I don't really see that as likely here. I think Michal here is a reference to a stream. In any case, I brought you on the sheet. If you take a look at source number two, number one is actually, I forgot I had put it on there. Source number one has the etymologies or the meanings of the names Merav and Michal. But in source number two, just to try to sum up what we spent some time on in recent weeks, I gave you a table of three views of what happened in the marriages between, or marriage with, David and Michal. So, remember that, as we said, Shaul tries to marry Merav to David, David declines, and she marries Adriel. But what was unclear in the text was that it said, at the time when Merav was given to David, she was given to Adriel. So the first line in the table in source number two, Rabbi Yossi, says that actually what that means is David had kiddushin, the first stage of halachic marriage, did happen for David with Merav, and therefore Merav was not supposed to marry Adriel, and whatever happened between Merav and Adriel was wrong. It wasn't supposed to happen. And then David marries Michal, and then Rabbi Yossi is bothered, because if he married Merav, he can't marry Michal. Man is not allowed to marry two sisters. So the answer is that this was after Merav had died, and therefore David was able to marry Michal. He's allowed to marry a sister after the first wife has passed away. That was Rabbi Yossi's view. Rabbi Yoshua ben Karcha said, no, the marriage between Merav and David, the kiddushin was attempted, but it was erroneous. We didn't really get into the discussion about what is erroneous about their kiddushin, nor do I plan to right now. But there was an attempt, like the text says, when Merab was given to David, something happened. And then, since it was erroneous, she could marry Adriel. And then David marries Michal. And that was the second view. Whereas most of the commentators who we read in the text said no. There's no such thing as a marriage or a kiddushin between David and Merav. The text says when she was given, it means when there was an attempt to do so. But it didn't actually happen. And therefore Merav goes off and marries Adriel and that's fine, and David marries Michal and that's fine, and there are no further complications. Clear? Janine?
Back to grammar.
Yeah.
I really like things other than grammar, but it just...
That's fine.
Jumps out at me. You know, I was thinking, I was looking up Vayehi Ba'eit. It talks about Yehuda. Vayehi Ba'eit, Vayere.
Yes.
The fact that it says Vayehi Mitna as opposed to Vitinate, I think points to something, I can see the basis for thinking that she already had been given to Adriel.
Yeah, no, and right. And I think I said that previously, that I can see reading it that way.
It's hard to read it other, because it sounds like the past, not...
Yeah, no, it... all true. No, it's all true. My problem was that it didn't fit... with Be'et, I had two problems with it. One was the Be'et Tate, but I had a different problem because Chana pursued this also. Chana's not here. But she had also emailed me afterwards trying to argue for Nitna, meaning that it had been done before. And I had another piece in the text, which 2 weeks later I don't remember, which seemed to argue against it. But no, I definitely understand the motivation for reading it that way and within the grammar, the motivation for reading it that way. Yeah. I'm not going to relitigate it. I mean, it is what it is. We've presented all the different possibilities and then some. And Michal is waiting for us. So what we now have to see are the next three psukim, the next three sentences, sentences 25 to 27. The timeline here is that Shaul, the timeline really is, it's right after what came before, meaning Shaul is trying to get David to agree by sending his servants with a message to David. It seems like this happens right away, meaning Shaul sending the servants and they have a conversation with David and all that. Shaul is not letting this go. This is happening right after what came before. So let's take a look. Pasuk Chaf Hey, sentence 25. Vayomer Shaul. Shaul says, Ko samru le David. This is what you should tell David. Remember that when David declined, he said to Shaul, he said to the servants, I am Rosh v'nikla. I am indigent. I'm a lightweight. You can't be serious about me marrying the king's daughter. So he says, Ein chefetz lamelech b'mohar. The king doesn't need a mohar. We talked about what a mohar was, right? We did that discussion. Okay, the gift prior to marriage, we talked about the Muslim institution also, we dealt with that. So, the king doesn't need a mohar. Ki b'me'a arlos plishtim lihina kem ba'oivei ha-melech. All you gotta do is provide 100 foreskins of the Philistines in order to punish the enemies of the king. V'sha'ul chashav la'pilas David b'yad plishtim. Shaul's plan being that David will fall into the hands of the plishtim. Now, I want to take some time to explain what's going on here. Clearly, if the issue of David's refusal is poverty, this makes a lot of sense, right? David is refusing, saying, "Well, I am indigent. I'm not somebody who can, who will be able to pay for it." So the answer is, I have a different kind of currency, and David, you're good at this kind of currency, so don't worry about it. This is a plot from Shaul to have the Plishtim kill David. The text said so. But it's a new version of the plot. Meaning that David is going to try to kill the Plishtim and bring back the Arlot as trophies. So it's a win-win for Shaul because either David is killed in the attempt or David succeeds and marries Michal, and therefore he's in greater danger. But the Malbim adds, and I think this was the last thing that we read last time, the Malbim adds that it's more than that. He doesn't say to David, be a general and fight them in battle. He wants him to do this solo attack. Take a look at source number 3, where the Malbim writes, Im lochamim v'hargim b'derech milchama. If they fight and kill in the manner of war, in bazem mistama, or mastema al hasara tzava. There's no reason for animosity towards the military officer involved. In other words, war is war. It's not personal. But if he's going to attack people who are secure, they were just sitting there on their own, they were minding their own business, and not only that, but aside from killing them, he's going to mutilate the bodies. That's not war. Rak derech tzareru mitnakeim. That is some kind of enemy attack. It's a punitive measure, as I translated it. Shebehechreach yishmua plishtim alav evag dolav yisnaklu linkombo. Oh, are they going to hate him for this one? They are going to get David for doing this. That is the way that Malbim reads it. What I wanted, though, to ask about is this the symbolism here of the Orlot Plishtim. Meaning, if he wants this to be an attack on the Plishtim, let him ask for their heads. Right? Bring me back 100 Philistine heads. Bring me back their swords, their shields. What in the world is that about? So, we generally speaking associate Brit Milah, circumcision, with our religious and ethnic identity. Right? This is the identity of a Jew, and I gave you in source number 4 on the sheet some obvious examples. Bereishit chapter 17, when Avraham makes the brit with Hashem in the first place, right? And it's a marker of Avraham and his descendants. In Shemot chapter 12, brit milah is a necessity for the Korban Pesach. You need that step of brit milah in order to be eligible for the Korban Pesach. For those who want to know more about that, the Beit Midrash Seder Companion will be out, God willing, in a week. And I have an article in there on that. Yoshua Perek Hey. Anybody remember what happens there? Alina, what? You're muted.
They did a mass circumcision for all the Jews who came into the land before Pesach, in Gilgal, I think.
Correct. And do you remember the phrase that the text uses to describe it, what the impact is on them? Hayom hasirosi as cherpas mitzrayim. I am removing, or galosi as cherpas mitzrayim. I am removing from you the shame of Egypt. When we learned Yehoshua together, which was quite a while ago, I think at this point. I think we probably did Yehoshua, that part of Yehoshua, I don't know, 7 years ago? Something like that. But when we did Yehoshua chapter 5, what I suggested was that removing the shame of Egypt was about the fact that the Egyptians viewed the Jews as being slaves in Egypt. That was our identity. Nothing else. We are slaves in Egypt. With no backstory. With no greater status. When they do Brit Milah, what they're really doing is connecting back to Abraham and Sarah. We're not slaves from Egypt who escaped. We are members of this great family from this land who were temporarily exiled and now we are home. Right? I think at the time I made that connection when Barack Obama gave his first speech in the Middle East. And he talked about Israel in what he considered a positive way, talking about how it was a homeland for the Jews after the Holocaust. And it's like, no, that's not what it is. That makes it sound like we're Europeans who had, you know, a terrible experience and therefore we get this land. No, no, no. Our history goes way back. We were here first. And that's the idea that is being expressed in Yehoshua. You do the Brit Milah there, you remove the shame of these are Egyptian slaves who fled by restoring our true identity, descendants of our ancestors in our land. That's the idea of Brit Milah for us, so much so. There's a Mishnah in Nedarim which deals with an issue of language, the way people speak. talking about returning to our land, or is joining from the waiting room. There's somebody who has returned to the land. So the Mishnah Nedarim talks about a case in which a person takes a vow saying they will not benefit from those who are either mulim, those who are circumcised, or those who are arelim, those who are uncircumcised. Person takes such a vow. The Mishnah Nedarim is filled with all sorts of weird vows. It's very hard for us to relate to it because we tend to avoid Nedarim. We avoid vows. Nonetheless, if a person takes a vow saying he's not going to benefit from arelim, people who are uncircumcised, it means he won't benefit from non-Jews. If there's a Jew who for some reason does not have a Brit Milah, he's not part of that class. Being a Jew, obviously I'm speaking to a women's class, but being a Jewish male puts you in the category of being mulim, automatically. And a non-Jew who had a circumcision for whatever reason does not enter the class of being mulim, of being circumcised. They're still in the class of arelim. The idea is that there is a national identity associated with Brit Milah. Now let's look at the Plishtim. The Plishtim are associated with lack of circumcision over and over and over again in Tanakh. We've learned some of them here. Take a look at source number 5. I gave you a list. These lists are incomplete, both of them. I didn't want to claim that these are thorough. Yeah, I wasn't searching for a lot of stuff here. Just wanted to build the case. So, first of all, Shimshon, right, the beginning of his career, he goes off and marries a Philistine woman. He says to his father and mother, please, this is the one I want. She is good in my eyes. And his parents respond saying, what, there are no Jewish girls for you? That's what they said. That you have to go among these arelim. Specifically using the term arelim, those who are without a Brit Milah. Then, Shmuel Aleph, Perek Yudalid, right, chapter 14, we saw it. Yehonatan is talking to his armor bearer, trying to encourage him to attack the Philistines with him. And he calls them, again, the arelim. And then, of course, when David is talking first about Goliath and then talking to Goliath, he calls him the Plishti Ha'arel, the uncircumcised Philistine. We don't use this term for anybody else. We don't talk about the Moavim Ha'arelim. We're talking about the Mitzrim Ha'arelim. Then you have the case here with the Mohar. And then later on, things we have not seen yet, Shaul, at the end of Shmuel Aleph, expresses his fear that he's going to get killed when he's trapped at the very end. And he says, these Arelim are going to come kill me. And then in the beginning of Shmuel Bet, when David is talking about the death of Shaul, he talks about the Philistines and the Philistine women as Benot Ha'arelim. So you see it there as well. So Diane asks me a question in the chat, which I had deliberately skipped because I don't think that you can really connect it here. But I'll mention it because Diane asked the question. She's right for asking the question. I just had skipped over it. And that is, what about Shechem? Right? What about the story with Dina in Shechem? What about that case in which they, you know, Shimon and Levi say, you want to marry us, you have to have a Brit Milah. So the reason I left it out is because they never intended to follow through. In other words, it wasn't a serious statement of, you need a Brit Milah and then everything is going to be fine. You know, that's going to make you kosher. It was just something said in order to make the people there vulnerable. However, to take Diane's point, the people in Shechem believed it. They viewed it as something that did make someone specifically part of the tribe. So you do have that there. Ricky and then Susan.
Is there any explanation as to why the Plishtim are called that?
Oh, well, that's where I'm going with this. My point is not only to say, look at that, the Plishtim get called this a lot, and, that's where I'm going. Yep. Susan.
Yeah. They have to cut up.
it's like mutilating a body.
It's not like, it is.
It is, okay.
Yeah.
Even though they're not Jewish, that mutilation seems really disgusting.
Yeah, no, this is not what we do. You are right for being bothered. That's why I'm discussing it. This isn't something that you can just like read and say, oh, okay, next story. This is a problem. We're not supposed to do that. I mean, we have a mitzvah of burial, right? There's a lot of halachic discussion about this. What in the world, not to mention, what in the world is Shaul going to do with this? Now what? Thanks a lot. So I have a few ideas here. I have a few different ways to go with it. But let me ask you first. Now that you see that this is clearly something greater than the event at hand, this represents something larger in terms of the identity of the Plishtim and the identity of the Jews. So what would you do? How would you explain this bizarre request of David? What does it mean? Not to mention David going along with it. Yes, Ruth. I do. I hear you much better.
Okay.
Yeah, Ruth.
Is he just trying to degrade them?
So you could certainly just say it's meant to be degrading. You could certainly say that. But seriously, like, there are other things you can do. This just seems like, this just seems vicious. Susan.
I'm wondering if it's like what you said about Shem. He doesn't really expect them to win or have it. So he's setting up an impossible situation, and that's part of it?
So,
like creating something that you can't really succeed in?
That's interesting. So in other words, this was like, I'm going to give him an impossible task. The problem is that he wants David, he wants David to get killed in the process. So you're saying he's giving him something to do that could get him killed. Okay, I hear that. I mean, it takes time, certainly, over the body to do this. So it's more dangerous to David. I hear that idea. Jeanette.
It seems to me that, especially from what the Torah tells us, from what the text tells us, that the whole point is to get the Plishtim as upset with David as they can be.
Yes.
And besides the explanation that you just gave that talks about what the Orla means to us, you know, in the context of the rest of the world, men are pretty, pretty squeamish about that part of their body.
Yes.
And something that would get them really, really mad. And if, you know, just like Susan said, I don't think it was Susan. It's likely he won't survive this. And if he does, they are going to be so mad.
Right. So this is basically where I was going to go with it. I have three other ideas first. So I'm going to come back to this. But yes, I'm gonna suggest that as well. Let me go through a few other ideas first. Take a look at source number 6. Avram Faust, The Biology and the Practice of Circumcision in Israelite and Philistine Societies, makes a very interesting suggestion that the Philistines were marked as unique in this era by not circumcising. Remember, the Philistines are invaders. They come in from the area of the Ionian Sea, Greece, Turkey, that area. So they're not like the Canaanites. They're certainly not like the Jews. Take a look at number 6. Circumcision, however, was practiced by many groups in the ancient Near East. And it is commonly accepted that if circumcision was an ethnic marker, it functioned mainly against the foreign Philistines who did not practice it. I mentioned to you that no one else gets called Arelim. Moab doesn't, Ammon doesn't, Edom doesn't, Edom is different. But he said, yeah, they really don't have it, and everybody else does. Interestingly, all the biblical texts that depict the Philistines as Arelim, uncircumcised, project this reality into the pre-monarchic period, meaning Iron 1 as opposed to Iron 2, regardless of their date, source, or genre. Now, Faust is coming from a standpoint that believes that biblical text is not divine written then and so on. So I'm not discussing that aspect of his work. The point that he's making, though, is that all the texts I referenced for you in source number 5, right, all the texts there that describe the Philistines as Arelim are all from the same era, which is to say, Iron 1. Not a single text, regardless of genre, uses this pejorative to describe the Philistines in the monarchic period, the period of the kings. We're going to encounter the Plishtim loads more times, but we're not going to call them Arelim anymore. This clear-cut dichotomy is supported by additional historical and archaeological lines of evidence, direct and indirect, and is in line with other changes in Philistine culture. All this seems to suggest that the Philistines started to circumcise in iron too, the time when they ceased to manufacture their Aegean-inspired decorated pottery, adopted the local script, changed their food ways, and so on. In other words, the Philistines start to blend in after this period of time and potentially start to circumcise as well. But right now, hang on 1 second, Sandra. Right now, this is an emblem for them because they stand out from everybody by not doing this. Yes, Sandra. So these are two ages. You know, when historians talk about the Bronze Age and the Iron Age and so on, it's when, specifically in terms of iron, it's when iron was adopted with increasing levels of sophistication. So iron one, if I remember correctly, is marked by chariots, for example. You know, and certain basic iron tools. And then in iron two, the use becomes more advanced. That's, so iron one is what he calls here the pre-monarchic period, the period before we have kings. It's the period of the shoftim, that time. Whereas iron two, he's saying, is already a little bit later. Someone sent me a message in the chat asking me why were other groups circumcising, and the answer could be religious motivation. The answer could be that they found the for themselves that it was considered cleaner, healthier, whatever. There are all sorts of reasons why cultures adopt things. But yeah, other cultures did it. We certainly were not the only ones. Leona, you're shaking your head, but I don't know why.
No, I'm just thinking that actually there are the tribes that had descendants that were our people. You take Moab and Amor and descendants. So because it was already customary through the descendants,
right. Well, that's why I skipped Edom and I skipped Yishmael. Ammon and Moab are relatives, but they're not descendants of Abraham. Sorry? But they're not descendants of Abraham. They're on the other side of the family.
Yeah, but they're still from.
Yeah, maybe.
From the Hebrews.
I can't disprove it. So one view would be that the reason why Shaul asks for this is because it's uniquely Philistine. I want you to bring me back the trophy that is uniquely Philistine. That would be one possibility. A second possibility is that it's a religious statement. Remember what Brit Milah means to a Jew. Ralbag said this back in chapter 14 when Yehonatan called the Plishtim Arelim. Take a look at source number 7. The Hebrews at the bottom of one side, English at the top of the next side. He said, let's go cross to the place where these uncircumcised are. Ramaz Mizeh, he hinted with this, because of their lower status, v'heyotam nivdalim, their being apart, ra'ui sheyu yonatam v'nosei kelav ne'ezarim b'shem yitbarach l'natzeach otan. God would help Yonatan and the armor bearer to be able to defeat them. Because they are not circumcised, therefore, they lack the covenant with God, and God won't protect them. Similarly, the Aruch HaShulchan makes a comment, Rabbi Chiel Michal Epstein, I didn't bring it on the sheet, he says, being called an Arel is an insult. It's a religious insult. So, a first approach is, bring me something that is uniquely Philistine. A second approach is, bring me the Orla that signifies the fact that they do not have our religious status, our religious benefit. I had a third idea, which has no basis anywhere, except that it makes sense. And that is, maybe this is supposed to mime uprooting their descendants. You know, by harming them with the Orla specifically, in the same way, I guess this is sort of a quasi-source. In the same way that when Avraham sends his Eved to go find a wife for Yitzchak, right? So he says, I want you to swear not to send my child, to send Yitzchak out of this land, right? So he puts his hand on his thigh, and the Medrash there explains he's swearing by the mitzvah of Brit Milah because it's about his descendants. So I wonder if, you know, here, taking the Orla is an act of uprooting their descendants. That would be a third idea. Ricky, hang on a minute, because I want to go through the fourth idea, because we already mentioned it, thanks to Susan and Jeanette, and I just want to play it out a little bit. And the fourth idea is that this would really deepen the enmity of the Philistines for David. We already saw Malbim about this being a non-military attack. An attack where you come in and you take territory, or you take wealth, is understandable. This is entirely different. This is a religious attack. It's, and, you know, as Jeanette said, something that they would be squeamish about. And I wonder if it's too strong to say that this attack would position David as the Philistine version of Amalek. In other words, to us, right, we have three reasons. We've talked about this. We have three reasons why Amalek is anathema to us, right? One, their cruelty to us. Two, their hatred to us down the line, going all the way back in their ancestry. And number three, their hostility to God, right? And we've given that. We discussed that, all the different sources that support each read based on the descriptions of the war with Amalek in the Torah. But here, you essentially position David as their Amalek. He's doing something that they would see as being cruel. He's doing something which they would see as an attack on their religion. I think that that's really what's going on here, is trying to, you know, he's asking David for the most heinous thing that he could do. Like, this is what I want you to do to the Plishtim. And David says, check. Got that. Okay, Ricky, what were you going to say?
Did I misunderstand it? When I was picturing this request, I understood that he was going to kill 100 Plishtim, and then he's going to...
Yes, no, that's the way the commentators understand it. He's not leaving them alive. Yeah, no. What you understand is what the commentators understand. They're dead. Yeah.
Otherwise, it would be really a little.
Otherwise, you'd have to go bring in a caterer to have a meal for the bris each time. It doesn't work. What if they've drawn this? No, we're not doing that. Susan and then Janine.
So why did David go along with this?
What do you think? It's a good question.
Yeah.
So I'm going to come back to this because I'm not quite ready, but hold the question. That's what I'd say right now. Janine.
Just curious, historically, do we know that the Canaanites practice circumcision?
So there is a lot of evidence, and that's what Faust is pointing to. When Faust says this was unique to them. Yeah, I mean, I've seen different statements about some of them. I've seen sources that say the Egyptians did it, and I've seen sources that say the Egyptians did not do it. I don't know the hard evidence.
But
in terms of the Canaan, and like I said, the answer seems to be, certainly Faust thinks the answer is yes, and I've seen things to support it. Yeah. No, but yes, the answer is yes. So, the servants communicate this to David, and David does it, and he doesn't wait. Take a look at Pasuk Chavav, sentence 26. Vayagidu avadav leDavid es hadvarim ha'ele. The servants communicate to David this, you know, request from Shaul. And again, we've talked about the men being, the avadim being an official line of communication. this is clear, that this is in the name of Shaul, because otherwise it doesn't make any sense that it would be, that David would accept it as Shaul's word. Vayishar hadavar be'enei David. This is yashar. This is good in David's eyes. What is good in David's eyes? Lishatein bamelech, to become the king's son-in-law. He says, okay, I want to become the king's son-in-law. Velo mal'u hayamim, and a lot of time doesn't even pass. David takes care of it right away, and not only does he do it right away, but look at sentence 27. Overachiever, this one. Vayakam David vayelech huva anasha vayach ba plishtim masayim ish. David goes and he kills 200 plishtim. Vayavei David es arlosehem, and David brings back their foreskins. Vayamalu'um lamelech lischatein bamelech. He says, here you go, I filled your quota. So you can marry the king's daughter. Vayiten lo Shaul es michal vito liisha. And Shaul presumably counts them up, says check, and says, okay, you can marry Michal. Okay, there's a lot going on here. So, first of all, the big question. Well, before the big question, just the phrasing that's used, velo mal'u hayamim, the days were not full. Radak reads that as there being a deadline. Like the servant said to David, it's not just do this and then you'll be able to marry her, but there's a deadline involved. So, as Susan asked, what in the world is going on here? Why is it that David changes his mind? What is driving that? So I would make three points. The first point is Abarbanel in source number 9. Come back to source number 8 shortly. First is Abarbanel in source number 9. Abarbanel says David's just been waiting for a price he can pay. He doesn't address the problem of, yeah, but why would you do this? David says, I can do this. Source number 9, V'sha'ol tzival ha'shiv lo, sh'lo yimanam b'nei zem yischatein bo. When David had said, I can't afford it, Shaul said, tell him that that shouldn't be an obstacle. Ki hu lo haya chafetz b'mohar u'matan, he didn't need some gifts. Achar ki'im b'mei arlos plishtim, only this 100 Philistine foreskins. Ba'amro sh'aya oses elina kemi oyevav, saying, I want you to punish my enemies for me. And David is looking at it in that context. This is a military thing. That's the way Abarbanel paints it. However, Ralbag gives me a second idea. And I think his idea is really, really important in understanding a lot of what's going to happen in the ensuing chapters. Take a look at Ralbag in source number 8. Remember that Ralbag has this pattern in which, in a lot of his commentary, when he concludes a story, he gives you lessons you can learn from the story. So this is lesson number 30 from this unit. He says, She'ein ro'oi la'adam she'yiya misarev me'od b'meshi yivakshu mimenu hagedolim. He says, a person should not be too strong in refusing when great people ask him for something. U'lezet timtza ki David haya misarev t'chilu lakachas es bas ha'melech mitzav meshes lachar shu bilti ro'oi la. So you see, you know, David refused when Merav was first offered, and when Michal was first discussed. He said, I'm not worthy. But when he saw that the king wanted him to do it, then he said, all right, fine, I'll do it. And he demonstrated his prowess to Shaul by doubling Shaul's request. The point that Ralbag is making is much bigger than don't decline too much. The point that Ralbag is making is David's relationship with Shaul. We are going to see over and over again, to the point where people will be virtually tearing their hair out, how David is going to show respect to Shaul even as Shaul tries to kill him. How David is, you know, he's going to spare Shaul's life twice when he has the opportunity to end it. How David is broken when Shaul is killed. You read his eulogy, not just for Yonatan, but for Shaul. It's not something that is easy to understand and explain to those, I think, who have not experienced a monarchy. But the way David looks at Shaul is my melech. And that's all I need to know. The Melech says, do it, I'm doing it. That's really, to me, that's what's driving David in this regard, and it fits his pattern throughout the next prakim, throughout the next chapters. I have one more explanation still, but I'm not there yet. There are a few things that we have to do first. Susan and then Nanette. Why is this not loyalty to Hashem in his eyes? Shaul is anointed one of God.
Right, but desecrating human bodies to that degree, especially the most personal area, you're not supposed to touch that area, all the halakha around that area. And you're saying he knows about all these halakha. Yes, Shaul's saying disregard them, but we know Shaul's downhill. David knows he's going mentally downhill. It just seems to me it would be like if Shaul said, go eat train. He wouldn't do it. This is no different.
So, number one, if Shaul says to David, go eat train, I'm not sure what David does, in all honesty. That's number one. Number two, I wouldn't overstate the prohibition aspis. Meaning it's true. We are prohibited against what's called nivul hamet. You're not allowed to degrade a body. And we have a mitzvah of immediate burial as well, which is apparently being violated if you're collecting the arlot. But tell me something. Can you remember a case we saw not that long ago in which David did both of these things? Yeah. He cut off the head of Goliath and marched around the country with it.
Yeah.
So he already has precedent for the idea that you can do this to someone, granting that cutting off his head is a little different from 100 arlot, and certainly 200. But in for a dime, in for a dollar. Sorry? Yes. But I understand what you're saying. But I think that there is something to be said for saying he has precedent. For saying, in the name of war, against the enemy, this may well be justified. I mean, I would hope he wouldn't have had a Jewish enemy to do it to. Doeg?
Yeah.
What about him? He is. David doesn't kill him.
No, but if David did, I don't think he would ever be ordered to go do something like that.
I understand what you're saying, but I can only tell you what I have in front of me. I don't know. Okay. Nanette, you've been waiting very patiently.
I think the principle, like Susan said, is monarchy, but in the sense that he is his king, and we were taught, again and again, that Saul was only the king because Hashem made him the king. That's the lesson. And so in a way, because he doesn't understand necessarily what he's being asked to do, if God puts Saul as the king, part of it is his emunah, like part of it is actually conducting yourself in a fashion because of who placed you, who's asking you to do that.
Yeah.
And in fact, maybe not understanding what you're being asked and conducting yourself accordingly is the greater deed.
You certainly have examples of that in the Torah, right? Akedah obviously is the most dramatic one, right? The binding of Isaac, but we have lesser examples as well. This is the instruction that you're given. I mean, the whole, to use Amalek as an example, right? The idea that they're killing children, goes against so much of not just basic Judaism, but even the rules of war in Judaism and in the Torah. But you are told, in this case, this is different. So that's a second idea, which I link to this Ralbag. I have a third idea still, but I'm not there yet. So let's see how far we can get, and maybe we'll get to it. This is, in order to reach this point, you have to ask, does David love Michal at this point? We've already noted that it doesn't say David loves Michal. It says Michal loves David. But we've also noted that you can read it both ways. Because we said that in general in Tanakh, when there are love relationships, it only says X loves Y. It doesn't say Y loves X. We don't have that. So there are commentators like Ralbag. We noted Ralbag already, I think, a couple of weeks ago, who says that David does love Michal at this point. But then Isaac Abarbanel says no. He said this is a political marriage. Take a look on your sheet, please. I skipped something in order to get to this point. I didn't mean to. Okay, first, very quickly, take a look at source number 10. Source number 10 was just explaining sentence 27. When sentence 27 says that David brought their orlot, vayimala'um lamelech, that was a very odd term, vayimala'um. He filled them to the king. What does that mean? So I brought you a little table in number 10 rather than bring you all the sources. One view in the Medrash in Bamidbar Rabbah says the word vayimala'um, mem lamed aleph, means gift. It means gift. So for example, in Parshas Naso, when the Nisi'im, the heads of each tribe, bring their gift, shnehem mile'im solet, they take mile'im to mean gift. Reminds me of a word in the Gemara, the word milai, mem lamed aleph yud, often means merchandise. So one way they read vayimala'um is he gave them as a gift. Rashi gives you an old French word, which there's a book called Otzar Laze Rashi, which explains his old French, and it says that the word that he uses is to present. Vayimala'um was he presented them. However, Radak and Abarbanel say it's that he completed a quota, in which case I think it's a pun. I think this is a pun. Because look, in sentence 26, we ended with velo mala'u hayamim, and now it's vayimala'um lamelech. I think there's a pun going on here. But that's a side note. But I did want to explain those words. You have two verbs, though. Vayavei, he brought them, and vayimala'um. So what does that mean? Well, Radak, in source number 11, it says, because vayavei is that David brought them, vayimala'um is that he sent them with servants. He did not hand them personally. That's Radak's way of reading it. Abarbanel says that David sent them with his own servants. And this goes back to the squeamish point a little bit. Take a look at source number 12. In the interest of time, I'm going to read out just my English translation. He did not bring them before Michal, these orlot, right? Even though he's going to marry Michal, for it would not have suited her tzniut. But he brought them before the king. And the text hinted that David did not bring them in his hands, for that would have been shameful for him, but via his servants. That's vayimala'um. Thus it says, and he completed them to the king, meaning that his men brought them before him, completing the quota. That's the way that it played out. Okay, that's just explaining the language. And he's doubling the gift, the commentators say, because he wants to demonstrate that he's worthy. But now let's get back to, again, the third explanation of why David goes along with this. Take a look at Abarbanel, please, in source number 13. He says, "Vizeh lo le'ahavat Michal." This was not out of love for Michal that David did it. "Ki mipnei hakavod li'itchatein b'melech." It's about the honor of marrying into the king's family. And here I bring you from Rav Bazak. Rav Bazak, whose poem some of you, I hope, enjoyed. His poem about people who are on Zoom with their videos off. So now we get, thanks Linda. His explanation here. This is in Torah as opposed to in a comedy poem. In an article that he published in the journal Megadim, going back 18 years ago. The article, if you look at source 15, you'll see the heading, the title of the article, Ma'arechet ha'yachasim bein David u'michal al reka yachasei Yaakov v'Rachel. The relationship between David and Michal against the backdrop of the relationship between Yaakov and Rachel. He notes that there are some very interesting parallels between the two relationships. right? If you already looked at source number 14, you can't answer this question. You've disqualified yourself by being a good student. But tell me, can you think of any parallels between the two stories? There are two sisters, correct. And marrying one when he thought he was going to marry the other, right?
The one,
yeah. Etty, what?
The older one is presented first.
The older one is presented first.
And he has no dowry for them, the mohair, so that's where the 7 years of work come in.
And is it only 7 years of work?
No, because
he ends up working 14 years. Take a look on your sheet at source number 14, please. Look at the parallels. Number one, you have a father-in-law who has two daughters plotting against his son-in-law. Right? I mean, Laban doesn't want to kill Yaakov at that stage, but he's plotting against him for sure. You have a son-in-law who gives double what is demanded, right? 14 years instead of 7 years, 200 orlot instead of 100 orlot, and we haven't seen this yet, but just like with Yaakov, where he flees after getting his consent, right? Yaakov goes to Rachel and Leah and asks them, you know, what he should do. And they say, yes, let's get out of town. So too, in the next perek, in chapter 19, Shaul is going to try to have David killed and Michal is going to enable David to escape. Also, ultimately, both of them come to some kind of peace arrangement, although with Shaul, you know, doesn't really last so much. The text itself highlights the parallels. We don't have time to go through all of the texts here, but I gave you the references in source number 14, where with Yaakov, when Yaakov says, I'm due to marry your daughter, Rachel, he says, Havayat ishti, give me my wife, ki mala'u yamai. My days are full, mala'u yamai. And here it's velo mala'u hayamim. Same term.
Is that being fulfilled? Yes.
Yes, that's the idea of a quota that's being fulfilled, correct. Not only that, in the next chapter, when they try to kill David, a major player in that story will be Trafim, which, of course, Rachel stole from Lavan. So the role of Trafim in breaking, in the daughter breaking with her father is very interesting. And ultimately, the peace deal that Yaakov and Lavan come to, is worded as, Lavan says, Elokei Avraham velohei Nachor yishpetu beinenu. The gods of Avram and Nahor should judge between us, yishpetu beinenu. Well, in chapter 24, when David comes up with his peace deal with Shaul, v'haya Hashem l'dayan v'shofet beini uveinecha. So that's shofet beinenu, shofet beini uveinecha. So right now, all we have is a set of interesting story links and textual links between the two situations. Tell me, what would you do with all of these parallels? So we have a bunch of parallels. It seems like too much to be random, especially the linguistic connections of mal'u yamai, mal'u hayamim, the trefim. Like, there's something going on here. But Shaul isn't Lavan. So what exactly is the message of all of these parallels? What would you do with this? Well, we don't know what happens to Lavan. Lavan disappears.
No, but we don't, but he's not killed, and he
right.
doesn't continue where we know Shaul's ending
yeah.
is not so great.
Yeah. So I don't know what to do with that. So yes,
I'm
Jeanette.
Sorry.
Jeanette, what?
I'm just, you know, Chas v'Shalom, I you know, Lavan and Shaul are not the same. But I'm wondering if it is a kind of a warning. It is a kind of a foreboding that when a father-in-law starts off tricking his son-in-law with small things, and actually what Shaul is tricking him with is almost big. It is bigger because
yeah.
he's looking, he'd be happy if he died. You know, he's looking. stressful, but it's a foreboding to say, this is getting, you know, this is not a good situation.
Well, certainly not a good situation. Let's take a look at source 15. Look at what Rav Bazak does. He says the parallels serve to highlight the difference. He says, Biram, Davka ha-hashva'ot ha'el, actually it's 226, I'll read my English translation. He says, but these similarities, specifically, sharpen the essential difference between the two stories. Even as the text reiterates repeatedly regarding Yaakov that he loved Rachel, right? Vayahav Yaakov et Rachel, vayu kiamim achadim bavatoota, vayahav et Rachel milaya, you see all the translations there, Yaakov loved Rachel, the 7 years passed like they're just a few days, he loves Rachel more than Leah. This emotion is entirely absent regarding David. The absence is specifically emphasized regarding Michal, because Michal loves David. Michal, daughter of Shaul, loved David. Michal, daughter of Shaul, loved him, the text says. More, during the flow of the chapter, the source of David's doubt about marrying Michal becomes clear. And David said, is it light in your eyes to marry to the king? And it was good in David's eyes to marry to the king. David doesn't see this as marrying Michal. The difference between the two stories, as Rav Bazak sees it, is that Yaakov loves Rachel, but David does not love Michal at this stage. Whether it ever develops later is another story. But it isn't here at this stage. And so, frankly, I could look at it and say, that maybe the highlight, what you're actually showing is that David does. In other words, you're paralleling the two stories, and just like Yaakov loves Leah, so too David, just like Yaakov loves Rachel, so too David loves Michal. But Rav Bazak's argument is no. You're showing how similar it is in order to highlight that which is different. And he says what David really wants, like Abarbanel said, is to be close to the king. That's really what David is looking to do. David wants to be close to Shaul, and using that, I come back to Susan's question. Why does David do something that is so difficult to understand? And not only does he do it, he doubles it. And the answer is, either you could take the first answer that I gave you, which we had said initially, which is that David's a military man, and this is a price he can pay. Or your second approach, my second approach, which is it's his relationship with Shaul. The honor that he shows to Shaul, the esteem that he holds Shaul in. And remember, this is before Shaul has overtly tried to kill him. David doesn't even know that Shaul's trying to kill him at this point. He hasn't figured that out yet. Or take this approach, it's because David wants to be close to Shaul and his family. He sees the value of marrying into the family, and therefore he's going to do what Shaul tells him to do. So what we have here, and I saw your hand, Claudette, hang on one second. Shaul is now back in the ball game, so to speak, after the thing with Merab didn't work. David is marrying Michal. David is characteristically successful, but in a way that's going to get the Plishtim very angry at him. And Michal loves David, which is going to come back to hurt Shaul in chapter 19. Claudette.
David knows that he was anointed to be king.
Yes.
But is it possible that he didn't know the route of how he's going to get there, and he's thinking that maybe being close to Shaul is this way that God is going to get him there?
Definitely possible. We did know, I think, in the previous chapter, when David was talking about the possibility of marrying the king's daughter as a prize for killing Goliath, I think we did note that there was the possibility that he saw at least in being close to the king in this regard. I'd have to go back and look at my notes. I just want to know, because Linda put it in the chat, she's right for asking, if that were really David's goal, though, then he should have married Merav instead of refusing Merav. But my answer to that would be, at the time he thought he wasn't really eligible. He said, I'm broke. And now he found out he's able to do it. So that would be the response, potentially. Claudette, you were going to say?
I have one concern about this part of the writing, what the writing did. Nowhere in this whole conversation is his brothers and his father. And if decisions are being made to marry, isn't it most likely that they will be involved?
Interesting. I mean, he's not. And they're alive, we know, because we're going to see them in a few chapters. But you're right. There's no consultation described here. I don't know what I don't know what the significance of it is. I don't know if we're supposed to read in that there's a dialogue going on. The text just chose not to preserve it, or whether the answer really is David's doing his own thing. I don't know. It's a very interesting question. David's certainly become independent at this point. He killed Goliath. He's a member of the royal court. He's a military officer. It could be that he's now doing his own thing, but I think it's an interesting point, especially given Yishai's status, as most of the commentators saw it. Thank you. All right. I look forward to continuing next week. Just in terms of schedule, to make sure we're all on the same page here. Today is March 4th, right? Today's the 4th? Okay. So God willing, we will have class on the 11th and on the 18th. And then we'll stop after that for Pesach break. All right. Be well.
Thank you. Have a good Shabbos.
Have a good Shabbos.